Hi, this is Whitley Strieber. Happy Easter. I'd like to let you know that in honor of this season, we are adding a chapter from the Afterlife Revolution to the end of both feeds. So you can listen to this. It's chapter 13, Soul as Second Body. It is a chapter about new discoveries regarding the Shroud of Turin that are pretty amazing and kind of give the lie to all of the debunking of this object that has gone on over the years. The Shroud of Turin is testament to the existence of second body. To understand this and take advantage of it, you don't need to be a member of any particular religion. The object is there, left for all of us, as a reminder that the soul is very real. So I thought it would be a good idea to just give you a listen over Easter. And of course, you can always get a copy of the book or the audio book on Amazon.com or basically wherever books are sold at this point.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, I'm going to read you a statement, and then we're going to talk to the author of that statement. After more than 20 years of focused involvement with the crop circles, I am delighted to confess that I do not know what is going on here. I have many ideas, hypotheses, and speculations, but I realize, and perhaps this is the charm of this phenomenon, that they are all hollow. Anyone who claims to know, anyone who professes certainties, is either a fool or a liar. This, I suppose, is as clear a statement of my position as possible. I would like to welcome an old friend back to Dreamland after too many years. From the center of crop circle country on Easter weekend, when the formations for 2018 are just beginning, welcome Michael Glickman.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, it's a joy to have you back, Michael. You know, here in the United States, we have been convinced pretty much that the crop circles are all tourist attractions made to draw people into the fields and have nothing to do with anyone except artists, human beings. I think that's a lie. I think it's a lie.
It makes me despair about the human spirit, really. People can believe what they like. There are no certainties. There are no absolutes. But I would simply challenge any individual who maintains that idea simply to give 15 minutes to follow it through. Who are these artists? Who is making money? There are no artists and nobody makes money. And these designs are too prodigious and divine to be random acts of vandalism. It's a myth. It's like the world being flat. I think we get over these things sooner or later.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's something that is been done using social control. Because I remember when I used to do crop circle shows every single year when we had the crop circle calendar on our website to sell every year, Lucy Pringle's lovely calendar. But then more and more researchers showed up in this country claiming that the circles were all made by artists and that they weren't real in the sense of being anomalies. And soon crop circle shows stopped working. People stopped listening to them. and the calendar stopped selling. People stopped buying the calendar. And so it worked. But I thought it was a lie from the beginning, and I found it terrifying. I've learned people love a lie. And I'm not saying this about my listeners, but most people wouldn't be listening to this show if they were easily fooled into being liars, into believing lies. But most people will believe a lie first before the truth. But let's not dwell on that. Let's talk instead about the miracle before us. And yeah, I have looked at your website, which is, by the way, Michael Glickman on cropcircles.com. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself. And you, this has been a lifetime dedication for you. Tell us where it started.
Well, I was an architect and designer and a teacher. And, of course, like most people, or like a lot of people, I was interested in the challenging and not instantly explainable. So I was aware that crop circles were forming, and I thought, ah, this is an interesting little problem. And I watched them, saw fuzzy black and white photos occasionally. And then in 1990, there was the gigantic first pictogram in Altenbarn, Eastfield. And that was in the national papers and one Saturday. And I was so blown away by this. I just thought, this is too big. And previous formations had all been based on a circle or a ring or something pretty simple. And this gigantic formation came down, which had straight lines and corridors and keys and claws and angles. And I thought, I must go down and see that. So I got into my car and drove down, and I was very simply transformed by this experience. I went into it, my first crop circle, July of 1990, and it was clear to me that this was from elsewhere. I was very arrogant. I was doing a lot of building and product design, and I was involved with factories and making things. And I thought very arrogantly that I knew how everything on planet Earth was made. I knew how plastic joined aluminium and how steel held glass, and I thought I knew everything. And I walked into this crop circle, and I knew immediately it was other. It was not in any way familiar. I could not in any way rationalize how anything so perfectly formed in detail could be manufactured in a field in the middle of the British countryside, mysteriously. And from that moment, I've never looked back. This will be now my 29th season. And I am still as delighted. I'm still as bewildered. I feel more privileged than ever to be close to it.
The formations have kept your sense of wonder alive. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be back in one moment with Michael Glickman. Well, it's lovely to be talking to Michael Glickman again, and I'd like to tell you about a couple of things. First, the summer lectures in Devizes. It's the only remaining conference devoted to crop circles, and it's a lovely, lovely conference. You can find out more information at temporarytemporals.co.uk. That's temporarytemporals.co.uk. The conference takes place on August 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Devizes in the UK. It's a lovely conference. We certainly enjoyed our time there. Also, you can enjoy the Crop Circles with Michael Glickman. Crop Circle Tea Time Seminars for Visitors is one of his offerings on his website, michaelglickmancropcircles.com. So if you're curious about the crop circles and what they really mean, or if you've dismissed them and have decided to take another look like I have, well, these are two wonderful things that you can do. Michael Glickman's website is michaelglickmanoncropcircles.com. His book, which has got a lot of five-star reviews on Amazon for good reason, is called Crop Circles, The Bones of God. Why not reopen your mind to this? This is what listening to Dreamland is all about. It's about opening your mind. And frankly, we've been duped into closing our minds to the crop formations, I think. And this is why Michael is back on the show. I've myself been in fact, the first crop circle I walked into, and I want to discuss this whole phenomenon in more detail, Michael, because I know you know a lot about it. A woman walked up to me and Anne and said, "Are you Whitley Strieber?" And I said, "Well, yes." And she said, "Well, how incredible that you're here now. I'm William Henry's fiance, Claire, and William and I have been hoping that we would meet, and we met by coincidence. We came to the crop circle with no idea that the other person was coming, and then suddenly there the three of us were." Now, that kind of synchronicity happens a lot in the fields, doesn't it?
Well, I have found, since I got involved with this, that and I'm not alone in this sense, but one comes to accept the strangeness of the phenomenon and what it seems to do, the coincidences and synchronicities, and kind of subconscious guidances that seem to recur and recur and recur. And if it was happening to just one person, humanity would shrug benignly and say, "Oh, well, he's kind of goofy, that guy, you know, with all these stories." But it's happening to dozens of people. It's become a commonplace in the season that everybody who comes closely in contact with this get some kind of intriguing synchronicity or message or nudge or reminder of something. There is, in my mind, no doubt that there is some kind of interactive, telepathic...
Something.
Yes.
Something very profound, because years later, after that meeting, Anne then in 2015 passed away, and one of the people who was among the first to confirm her existence, continued existence in the afterlife, which I go into detail with in our book, The Afterlife Revolution, was none other than Claire Henry. So it's just, if we had never met Claire, that would never have happened. It's remarkable and extraordinary, and it's one of the reasons you're back on the show, because I have to admit, I became very suspicious of the crop formations, because I was hearing so many stories and seeing some formations, like one that was apparently commissioned by a glass-blowing company that were really very convincing, at least from a distance. What is the truth, though, here?
The one you're talking about, Anstey, was phenomenally real. It was extraordinarily real. But
so I had a feeling it was. Tell us why that is.
Well, there's one very simple thing that has never really been dealt with. And it's this. If I ask you, if I give you a piece of paper and a compass, and I say, draw a circle, you will find it very easy. But until you prick the paper with the needle of the compass, thus defining the center, you will not be able to draw the circle. A circle has to have a center and a radius. That is, this is from the center to the perimeter. And what Anstey provoked here was the fact that there was something like 8 or 9 concentric circles, that is, circles requiring a shared center. But the center itself was completely immaculate and undisturbed. So that this was like saying to you, draw a perfect circle on paper without sticking the compass point into the paper. It's very hard to do. And to manage at the scale of a crop circle, 8 or 9 concentric circles, which presumably one would do by either staking the center or by standing and holding a rope, it would be impossible without causing substantial damage to the standing crop. Now, in Anstey, there were 3 beautifully designed leaves right at the center. The center was undisturbed. Now, the following year, this year, last year, 2017, as though really to confirm our discussions, we had a formation at Woolstone Hill, which had 18 separate, perfect standing discs with no damaged dead centers. Now, how do you do that? I would like somebody to show me. I'm open to the possibilities. I have been for 20 years that there are people who can make crop circles.
But they're never there. That's the problem.
No.
I've never met, you know, I've met people who claim to make crop circles at the Little Ale Inn. And
yes.
Yet they never would do it.
And the other thing, of course, is that everybody nowadays is carrying a video studio in their pocket.
Right.
Why don't they film it?
Right. And well, it wasn't called the Little Ale Inn. That's the one in near Area 51.
Yes.
The one in Devizes was called
the Bud.
What?
The Bud, Elton Barnes.
Yeah, that's right. It's closed now, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think it will be reopening, but we don't know.
Well, in any case, I spent some time there talking to people who claimed to make crop circles and wanted to go with them to watch, and they claimed that they couldn't do it if they were being watched. And what? So if they were really telling the truth, then the anomaly is, why can't they be watched? Who are they really then? In other words, they weren't doing it. They were only claiming to. But why, Michael? Why do people hate and fear the question?
I tell you why. Because what we need for survival is the guarantee that tomorrow is going to be broadly the same as today, and that today will be broadly the same as yesterday. And so when something comes in which knocks firmly on the door and says, I am going to change your world, many people are very frightened.
They're very similar.
It's a basic earthly instinct to preserve that which we know and that which we can be sure of. And the crop circles are amazingly discreet and secretive. This is the other intriguing thing. What kind of organization in the world can maintain the level of secrecy that the crop circles have maintained for over a quarter of a century?
Well, especially because early on, for example, as you know and can tell us about, the BBC was among the many organizations that made a very serious effort to see this being done.
Yeah.
And they failed.
Well, the truth is, the efforts to put this under the blanket, the efforts to kick it into the long grass, the efforts to make it forgotten and ridicule it are enormous. And they're so enormous, they touch something primitive and visceral in the human community spirit. We do not want to know.
Well, right. We hate the unknown. We hate it.
Yeah.
But not my listeners. My listeners are here because they don't hate the unknown. They're very unusual people in that respect. They're all sitting out there. I can literally feel them thinking to themselves, well, I don't hate the unknown. That's why I'm here. And so you've got an audience now to talk to who is saying to themselves, yeah, let's keep looking down this path. Let's keep walking down this path. Free Dreamlanders, speaking of paths, walk down this path with our sponsors, probably most of them, other versions of things we want you to do on unknowncountry.com, like subscribe and buy The Afterlife Revolution. We'll be right back. Well, it's lovely to be talking to Michael Glickman again, and I'd like to tell you about a couple of things. First, the summer lectures in Devizes. It's the only remaining conference devoted to crop circles, and it's a lovely, lovely conference. You can find out more information at temporarytemporals.co.uk. That's temporarytemporals.co.uk. The conference takes place on August 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Devizes in the UK. It's a lovely conference. We certainly enjoyed our time there. Also, you can enjoy the Crop Circles with Michael Glickman. Crop Circle Tea Time Seminars for Visitors is one of his offerings on his website, michaelglickmancropcircles.com. So if you're curious about the crop circles and what they really mean, or if you've dismissed them and have decided to take another look like I have, well, these are two wonderful things that you can do. We're talking to Michael Glickman. His website, michaelglickmanoncropcircles.com, a lovely website, by the way. His book, and it's not his only book, but it's his most recent book, is Crop Circles, The Bones of God. I have read it, and it will take you down some very mysterious and mind-opening paths. It's well worth your time. You can get it by going to the Dreamland show page and simply clicking through from there. Or if you want to avoid our getting a little bit of extra from it, you can go directly to Amazon and get it there. So we continue on face to face with this mystery. And Michael, what is in recent years, what, for example, has been happening that stands out in your mind as being exceptional or particularly important in the formations?
Well, there are fewer formations annually. the number, the quantity, has taken something of a dip. But we should recall that circles have appeared and are catalogued in over 60 countries, and there have been something in the order of 7,000 recorded formations in these 60 countries. So while I think the Pusey Vale here in Wiltshire is the absolute epicenter of the phenomenon, it's worldwide. But the numbers have gone down. We had rather less than 40 in England last summer, but they were of a quality and a variety and an inventiveness and an art which was breathtaking. I mean, I have the drawings of last year's harvest on the wall in my living room, and I sit with them now, and they're astonishing. And I would say to your readers, listeners, they should sell their house, sell their car, and buy a ticket to England for July and August and come over and see this. It's the one chance we've got to witness
I'll never forget. I had the good fortune to be, Ann and I did, to be invited to Devizes in 2009 to speak. And we got to enter crop formations, quite a few of them, because it was a good year. I'll never forget it. I was blown away by what I found and what I saw and what I felt. And tell us a little bit about it, some of the experiences, the personal experiences you've had in the formations. I know you've had quite a few remarkable experiences.
Well, it's an endless litany. I mean, one of my favorite little stories is that I was asked to do a geometry workshop some years ago, I think 2008. And I always start the geometry workshop with the Vesica Pisces, which is two overlapping circles, which in sacred geometry is the first step in an endless geometric sequence. And in this seminar, I take people through and show the power of these two overlapping circles, the Vesica. And the event was on a Saturday in June, and I hoped, and we were in Alton Barnes, right at the heart of the crop circle thing, and I hoped, rather vainly, that to commemorate the event, we might receive a crop circle. Well, we didn't. We didn't receive one at all, and I was very upset. But two or three days later, I discovered that a perfect Vesica Pisces crop circle had appeared on the Saturday morning of the event, but it has appeared in Sicily, where I go every year for a week after the crop circle season, and it had appeared 45 minutes from my hotel, and it was a perfect replica of my initial diagram, and it appeared on June the 8th, which was the date of the event. Now,
good heavens.
One can simply shrug and say, oh, what a coincidence.
But maybe it's not, because, you know, you're talking to a person who lives with the close encounter experience every day of his life, and it's like that. It's always like that. It's very playful and
indirect, and it keeps you guessing and thinking always.
Yes.
It's a teaching tool. I think the crop formations are a teaching tool. I think they're there to inspire questions that we cannot ignore and cannot answer. And I fear that we are beginning to ignore these questions, and which is why the number of formations is declining. And I think that the crop circle debunkers have been very effective in making this happen.
The crop circle debunkers have been very effective at the level of reducing the publicity for this event or these events in the public media. But the phenomenon itself is undisturbed by the reaction of humanity. It has its plan, and it's a grand plan. I don't quite know what it is, but I think this project is going to continue whatever we do and however we respond.
Well, when
I just have enormous
optimism
about the power of this.
Your optimism about this is infectious, and it's amazing, because you have really been through the ringer, Michael. You have been working on this and living with the frustration of the denial and the debunking for so long. You know, I remember very well at the beginning when Doug and Dave were trotted out, apparently by the Central Intelligence Agency, and I listened as National Public Radio here in the United States delivered a sneering, snickering pack of lies to the public that was immediately picked up by the rest of the media. And I thought, my goodness, the breathtaking power of evil and the breathtaking power of the dark side. They want so badly to blind us to the wonder around us, and ultimately also the wonder that is mankind. In the second half of the show, we're going to be going deep into the question of wonder, and we're going to be talking about some formations that remain in a part as truly extraordinary and more comprehensible communications. What is being said here? Free Dreamlanders, thank you as always for listening, and I do hope that you decide to subscribe and keep this show going. We're hurting, and we need your support. Michael Glickman's website is michaelglickmanoncropcircles.com. His book is Crop Circles, The Bones of God. And now let's listen to Chapter 13 of Afterlife Revolution. And again, Happy Easter, everyone. Chapter 13, Soul as Second Body. We're told there's no such thing as second body. Don't bother to look. Nothing like that has ever been recorded or ever will be. So don't imagine for a moment that you have a soul, let alone that hungers for work and longs to understand and use soul tools, that wants to help itself and others, that loves all that it meets with encompassing objectivity. Second body has been recorded. There's a photograph of it. One single picture. It was left behind 2,000 years ago, almost as if in anticipation of the eventual coming of an era when the soul would be generally dismissed and forgotten. It is, if you will, an argument on behalf of the soul left behind with amazing insight long before the debate had even begun. It's been ruthlessly dismissed, debunked, as they now say, but that is a lie. In 1977,
Anne and I attended a meeting at which Father Peter Rinaldi was scheduled to speak about the Shroud of Turin. He showed images of the relic and spoke about the Shroud of Turin research project, which was then just being formed. It was an impressive presentation, and we both found the positive images taken of the negative on the shroud to be perplexing. We contributed some money to the project and went on to continue to follow it over the years. The initial result appeared to show that it was indeed a piece of cloth from the first century A.D., and that the image had been produced by a very brief, very intense burst of light. But then, in 1988, three separate laboratories carbon dated it to approximately 1260 to 1390 A.D. We were disappointed, but also suspicious. By then, I had been out of my body. I knew that the soul existed, as I had been in the soul state. The first person to see me OBE had already reported her experience to me. I had been trying to find friends and had ended up in her bedroom in the middle of the night. She lived in a city 1,000 miles from New York, and I did not appear to be entirely solid as I stood at the foot of the bed gazing at her. She was understandably furious and didn't talk to me for years. But the event confirmed to me that the out-of-body state was real. So I knew for certain that what many people call subtle body or second body, or as I do, soul, was, just like the physical body, part of nature. I was studying it not through science, but through the enormous literature of the soul and the work of the lively academic community that is devoted to it. Science may have retreated, but the academic world has not. Later, when I met the people from Between Lives who meditated with me and saw that they could affect the physical world in a number of different ways, I understood that souls that are correctly prepared can still affect the physical. So I suspected that the man of the shroud, whoever he was, had been able to control his second body. I knew also that the scientists involved in the carbon dating had for the most part started with the assumption that the shroud could not be evidence of soul life because such life did not and could not exist. A few months before these results were announced, I saw just how powerful such denial can be in a mind that is not prepared to accept that there is more to reality than it believes. We had a group of people at our cabin, among them a dear friend, Dr. John Glideman, a psychologist who was also a physicist. He had seen enough at the cabin not to be completely skeptical about my experiences, but he was in complete denial when it came to the soul. He had been trained to believe facts and had fallen with the rest of the scientific community into the trap that only facts currently understood can exist. The group of us went one morning to the clearing where I had originally been taken up by the visitors into their crowded little vehicle. As we were meditating together in a circle, a gorgeous beam of pure, clear light shone down from above. I was sitting in the center of the circle and felt it surround me with what I now understand from Anne's teaching was objective love. Of course, at the time, I didn't understand. I could see the light around me and feel the love, but intellectually, I was at a loss. The others sitting around the circle all saw the light, all except Dr. Glideman. He simply could not see it. About 10 minutes after it stopped, the group of us went up to the cabin, excitingly discussing what had happened. We were in what I would describe as a state of joy. The light had been very beautiful and had come with a wonderful, warm sense of love that felt remarkably compassionate and, well, just happy. It was happy light. John continued to claim that he had seen nothing. I am sure that he was telling the truth, too. He soon had a debilitating headache. One of the members of the group, Dora Ruffner, was a body worker, and she spent the afternoon trying to help him with it. I knew what that headache was about.
In the months before I finally opened my mind to the close encounter experience and was able to remember what had happened to me in December of 1985, I would have a headache just like it every afternoon. This was because I was pushing away what I was seeing at night. I could not admit it into my reality, not without seeing my whole view of the world collapse into chaos. It is that fear of chaos, the mind unmoored, that drives all of the denial that curtains off reality. We live in the world as it appears, not as it is. In other words, we live by assumptions. We cling to them, desperate not to fall into the reality of mysteries and questions in which we actually live. Dr. Glidman was in the same predicament. Something had appeared in his experience that was outside of what he believed to be possible. Many people, not just scientists, would have had the same experience he did, I feel sure. We cling to a limited worldview for many different reasons, and only patient inner work over time can pry us loose from it. Anne says, "It's locked expectations. They narrow the slit through which you view the world even more than nature does. Unlocking them takes patience, self-respect, and an openness to new possibilities. Look into the eyes of an infant. There you see unlocked expectations. Go as far back as you can into your own childhood. Remember how it felt then to be alive. That's how to start opening your expectations. To be truly awake is to have none." Clinging, like John and I did, to our locked expectations, the scientists who did the carbon dating could not allow it to show the actual age of the cloth, no matter how objective they believed themselves to be. In fact, they could not have been. And indeed, it has since developed that some of the fragments of material that were removed from the shroud for the experiment may have been part of a repair that had been made at a later time, although admittedly not all. But the fact that the cloth was in a fire could throw off carbon dating. This, however, was not taken into account. Subsequently, more and more evidence has accumulated that the shroud is indeed from the Roman period. In 2009, Barbara Frail, a paleographer at the Vatican Archive, imaged the shroud and found writing on it, identifying it as the burial cloth of Jesu Nazarene, a description that would not have been used in the Middle Ages. It would then have been heretical not to identify him as Christ. His Roman executioners would have labeled his shroud in this way. In 2015, geneticists at the University of Padua analyzed DNA on the shroud, determining that the most abundant human DNA came from Druze people, meaning that it was probably in the Middle East for an extended period of time. But there is no way to account for this if it was a 14th century forgery. Also, the oldest DNA found on it came from India, not Europe, where the forgery is supposed to have taken place. The herringbone weave of the material would have been extremely rare in first century Jerusalem, something reserved for only the most luxurious cloths. It would have been even more so in 14th century Europe. Only one sample of similarly woven linen has ever been found from the medieval period. This is an important finding because it means that the cloth on which the image appears would have literally cost a fortune. But what forger would spend that on something intended to make a profit in the thriving relic markets of the 13th and 14th centuries? It would also have been an extremely valuable item in the Jerusalem of the first century, something that would have been used in the burial only of a person of high stature and affordable only to an elite few, like, for example, Joseph of Arimathea. Another burial shroud has been recovered from a first century tomb near Jerusalem. It is definitively carbon dated to the first century CE. It is layered together, not woven, and is made of wool and linen, not pure linen. In 2017, it was announced that the red marks on the shroud are human blood, and not only that, that the blood was from a person who had been stressed, probably by torture. In a peer-reviewed paper entitled Atomic Resolution Studies Detect New Biological Evidences on the Turin Shroud, published in PLOS ONE by Elvio Carlino, Cinzia Giannini, and Giulio Fanti of the Institute of Crystallography in Bari, the authors write, "We used atomic resolution transmission electron microscopy and wide-angle X-ray scanning microscopy experiments, studying for the first time the nanoscale properties of a pristine fiber taken from the Turin Shroud. We found biological evidence of nanoparticles of creatinine bounded with small particles of iron oxide. The kind, size, and distribution of the iron oxide nanoparticles cannot be dye for painting, but are ferrohydrate cores of ferritin. Consistent bound of ferritin iron to creatinine occurs in the human organism in case of a severe polytrauma. Our results point out that at the nanoscale, a scenario of violence is recorded, funeral fabric, and suggest an explanation for some contradictory results so far published. Thus, the previously published claims that the markings are paint appear not to be correct based on this more sophisticated test. While there still isn't conclusive proof that the shroud is of Middle Eastern origin, or that it was created during the first century AD, or that the man of the shroud is a Nazarene called Jesus, there is now a significant amount of evidence that all of these things are true. There have been many efforts to duplicate the image on the shroud, and some of them appear at first to be convincing. However, all efforts to use a camera obscura such as might have been available in the Middle Ages leave an image on the linen that is much deeper than the one on the shroud. Physicist Paolo Di Lorazzo of Italy's National Agency for New Technologies, Energy, and Sustainable Economic Development, an expert on the shroud, explains the problem. The color's penetration into the fabric is extremely thin, less than 0.07 micrometers, 1/30th the diameter of an individual fiber in a single 200-fiber linen thread. He went on to tell the National Geographic in 2015 that the ultraviolet light that would be necessary to create the shroud image exceeds the maximum power released by all ultraviolet light sources available today. In addition, pulses having durations shorter than 1/40 billionth of a second and intensities on the order of several billion watts would be necessary. No energy release like this is possible now, nor has it ever been possible. And yet, the Shroud of Turin exists. A flash of energy, light, of extraordinary intensity and extreme brevity, caused the image to appear. What the effect, if any, of such an event might have been on the rate of carbon decay in the cloth is unknown. So the shroud remains a question on two levels. First, there is the carbon dating that suggests a medieval origin. Second, there is the impossible nature of the image and the fact that it cannot be duplicated without causing a much deeper burn than is in fact present on the cloth. And then there is that remarkable flash of light. I have seen beings of light with my own eyes. I have been suffused in it and sometimes during deep meditation seen it inside my own body. I know this light, although not obviously at the intensity that created the image on the shroud. I think that this light is subtle body, second body, or soul. It is, in a larger sense, being. And as Annie has said, God is the community of being. If we look to what was seen after the resurrection of Jesus, what we find is the emergence of a second body of breathtaking power. In fact, the most powerful manifestation of the soul ever recorded in the history of this species. Anne was a scholar of the Gospels, and one of our most frequent discussions involved whether or not the resurrection happened. We explored the idea that Jesus might have had a twin, which is part of the very ancient tradition of the Syriac church, for example. But if he did, why were the apostles surprised to see him after his death? They would have simply assumed that this was the twin, and surely in that small world the existence of this twin would have been known. During Jesus' lifetime, there would have been no reason to keep him secret, and certainly after Jesus was executed, the last thing a twin would have wanted to do would have been to start walking the streets. The reasons that the Romans executed Jesus were two. First, he was openly claiming to be the Jewish king, in direct opposition to their own puppet king, Herod. As a Nazarene, he would have been considered a descendant of David, and thus a far more legitimate claimant than Herod. Second, when he attacked the money changers, he threatened the flow of money into the temple, and thus the whole financial edifice on which the stability of this new Roman province depended. He was a political rebel, and he was killed for that reason, but only after he appeared in Jerusalem. The Romans didn't care what he did in Galilee. They knew that the Galileans would never follow him. This was because, just a few years before his birth, there had been an uprising in the area, and the central Galilean city, Sepphoris, had been sacked by the Romans, and its citizens either sold into slavery or crucified by the thousands in the surrounding hills. The Galileans heard only the political side of his message, not the subtle, stirring moral message. All four gospel accounts of the resurrection mention that beings of light were present in the tomb when the two Marys went to anoint Jesus' body. John says that there were two of them dressed in white. Matthew describes a single being, his appearance like lightning. Mark describes his clothing as lightning white. All four gospels agree that he was dressed in white. As I have said, I have seen somebody who could easily have been described as lightning at one point. When he was in physical form, the tunic he wore was white. So as far as I'm concerned, such beings are as real as we are. The one I saw in physical form was careful not to move, I think because he was concentrating very hard in order to appear as a material being. But Jesus walked with his followers. At one point he even ate with them, and of course placed the hand of Thomas the twin into his wounds. Anne always maintained that this was his twin brother, and he appeared with Thomas to prove that he was not the same person. And then we would wonder if he really even died on the cross. She was certainly very good at enjoying the question, and I recall those conversations with fondness and longing. If, as it would appear, what came out of that tomb was Jesus' second body, still in coherent form, he must have had a very powerful attention and a fantastic ability to sense himself in order to manifest so clearly to people. It is my belief that it takes two things to accomplish this depth of soul sensation, lightness of being and strength of attention. The man I saw could never, I don't think, have walked around a room. I doubt that he could even have spoken, and given how rarely it is done, he must have been a real master of the skill. Jesus was very extraordinary, but at the same time, judging from the deplorable condition of the poor fellow who left his image on the shroud, also very much what he said he was, a son of man, who had been treated with great cruelty by the Romans. To assert that the resurrection really happened, and I think that it did, is not also to say that the tenets of Christianity, as they emerged in the centuries following the event, must be followed to the letter. On the contrary, to understand his message, it is probably best to go to documents like the Gospel of Q, which is a compendium of consistent statements from the Gospels that scholars believe represent an earlier document from which they were all derived. It's all about light, Whitley, letting the light enter you. But you have to have a loving heart, show compassion, and be humble enough to open yourself to it. It feels, Annie, a bit like disappearing. Ego does disappear. It doesn't end, but it steps aside to let the soul take the attention. That's what it means to become a clear glass through which God can shine. So we have been set quite a challenge by this man who lived and suffered and died among us so long ago. But now, as we come to the time when Earth's womb is no longer able to contain us, we need to revisit that message in a new way, with pure hearts and in true humility. It's evening now, a warm summer night, and I remember back across the river of evenings I spent with her. When our work was done, we would make our supper and converse together. Such precious times, and I feel her now as I did then, her rich conversation and her humor. She used to say, "People are all too ominous about the Gospels. Jesus had a great sense of humor. He accepted that people fail, and he forgave." She used to laugh about Mary Magdalene at the tomb as her visit is described in John, thinking that Jesus was the gardener. The green man was a fertility god in much of Europe, replaced by Jesus as the resurrected one. Anne often wore green to public events and encouraged people who came to see us to do the same. She said it was the color of those who loved life. She used to say, "I'm a resurrectionist. That makes me a green Christian." She meant that Christ is identified with the old pagan green man all over Europe. The resurrected Jesus is the pagan god of fertility in a new form, not as the rebirth of plants and the things of the earth, but as the rebirth of the soul. When we realize that the shroud really did tell the story of the resurrection, it changed us both profoundly. It freed Anne and delighted her. She would say, "The resurrection didn't just happen at a certain time. It happened outside of time. It's always happening. You can feel it." I couldn't. I guess it's my Catholic upbringing, but I worried too much about sin to really embrace something as wondrous as that. The worst curse that was visited on Jesus after he left the world was the one that claims that he was in some way special, apart from us, a deity separate. When they started calling him Christ, that was the darkness within us, trying to put out his light. He was just a guy, Whitley, who had surrendered completely to the light. That's why it shone through him so brightly. I still worry, Annie. I worry about being sinful. Well, let's talk about it. How it weighs us down, that's what I worry about. We don't see sin that way at all. Here, it looks like a disease. That's surprising. I've never heard that before. Sin, seen objectively, looks like sores. That stops me. A memory tries to surface. Then I realize what it is, and I'm shocked, moved. I haven't thought about this in years, and now here it is, come to mind again, this time with the power of revelation. Back in the 1980s, I had a very striking dream, what's called a lucid dream. In it, I was walking along a road in a pleasant area of low shrubs and bush. It was about midday. As I walked, I noticed some movement in the brush. The dream was so vivid that I was as wary as I would have been in real life. As is often the case, I had the sense that I was not exactly dreaming, but also that this was not exactly the real world, at least not our real world. Out into the road came a man, naked and filthy. My immediate reaction was to try to help him. However, as I looked at him, I realized that he was covered from head to foot with livid, running sores. I couldn't imagine how I could help somebody in a state like that, and I didn't want his infection to contaminate me. I stepped back, moving away from him. He came toward me, reaching out to me. But he was slow, barely able to move because of the encrustation of scabs and infection that covered him. I woke up. It was still dark. I sat up in bed. I was covered with sweat. For a moment I thought that I was going to vomit, but the sensation passed. I went into the bathroom and got a glass of water, then went back to bed. For nearly 40 years now, that dream has lingered in the back of my mind. I sensed that it was important, but didn't know why. About 15 years later, I saw him again. He was better, many of the sores healing. Annie says he was giving up his regrets, his sins. Evil acts here are remembered only in regret. His soul was sick with regret. Then if he'd just forgotten about his sins, he would have been fine. No consequences. You can't forget a single second of your life, Whitley. Not anything. No filters here. No pretending. If he can't forget, does that mean the sores are there forever? Remember, put those burdens down. Easier to do that when you're still in the physical, which he could have done but didn't. The brain is a wonderful instrument. It can cause soul infection, but it can also heal it. We think in terms of good and evil, Annie. That's a level of emotion that stays with the physical. We see sick souls, not evil people. No punishment? Do you think he wasn't punished? God gave him the sores then, Annie? His life gave him his regrets, and only he can reconcile them. Nobody can cure us but ourselves. There are no miracles here. Once again, no miracles, just nature. It is so important to remember that the world of the soul and conscious light is a natural world. It is like everything else, part of nature and subject to the laws of nature. In that sense, the resurrection was a natural event, the light bursting out through a man who had surrendered himself to it entirely. So also, the man covered with sores, he was part of conscious light too, and also part of nature. Both of them, the first and the last, were part of the same aim, the journey into ecstasy that is the reason that everything exists, and why those of us who have been given the gift of intelligence are so precious. Everything that is on the journey, but those of us with knowledge of life and death and the life beyond, we know it. That's why he died for us, because we know and are alone in what we know of death and doubt the world beyond. The greatest act of compassion ever seen on this earth was not Jesus letting himself die on the cross. It was what came after, which was the revelation that second body, the soul, is real. It was the resurrection.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.